Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you again today. Great as always to have your company. Coming up on the programme, why have plans to update a crumbling airport caused so much anger across Kenya, and what impact the protests the proposals have sparked having on businesses?
We were supposed to have 21 departures this morning, and we've only had 7 of them. That's right.
And presumably that could have a massive financial impact on you guys.
Absolutely. More importantly, a lot of inconveniencing to our customers.
Much more from the boss of Kenya Airways in just a moment, and we'll also be crossing live to the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, as well for the very latest then. Also on the programme today, in last night's presidential debate, the Democratic Party candidate Kamala Harris doubled down on her message to the shale gas industry.
I will not ban fracking. I have not banned fracking as Vice President of the United States. And in fact, I was the tie-breaking vote on the Inflation Reduction Act, which opened new leases for fracking.
Yeah, we'll be in the US as well to see what reaction there's been both to that from the industry and environmental campaigners as well. And what makes a good coffee shop? We'll hear why the new boss of Starbucks is betting its cozy seats as he looks to turn the company's fortunes around. All that to come, as I say, throughout the programme, but let's start back in East Africa in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, because protests we told you about yesterday on the programme have intensified today, causing widespread disruption. I don't know if you can make it out there, but protesters outside Jomo Kenyatta International Airport calling for the Indian conglomerate Adani to go. Adani must go, they were chanting. They want the company to be kept out of plans to redevelop the crumbling international airline hub. Our reporter, Jewel Karungi, has been at the airport all day and joins us now from outside Jomo Kenyatta International. Jewel, thanks for being with us on World Business Report. Before we get into the latest, remind us what this row is all about.
Well, Will, a lot of the airport workers are defiant as to the government's decision to lease the airport to the Indian group Adani. They say that this decision would put their jobs at risk, really, because they would have to renegotiate their terms while working for a new management. They say that they have tried to reach out to the government several times to seek audience with them to have their grievances heard, but that has not been the case. And they say that this strike is their last resort, trying to get the government's attention as to why they are against this deal.
Right, we're going to hear more of that view in a moment, because Jewel's been speaking to the union and to the government this afternoon. But first of all, let's get you up to speed with the disruption caused by the protests earlier in the day. And it was pretty immediate. In fact, the BBC's Africa Bureau editor, Stuart McLean, found that out to his own peril.
I arrived just as the sun was coming up for an early flight this morning and was one of hundreds, probably more than 1,000 passengers stuck outside the airport. The doors to both the domestic and the international terminal here at Nairobi's main airport had been closed, and a major strike of all airport workers had started at midnight with nobody going in at all. So for quite some time, people were standing really not knowing whether they were going to get into the airport at all. A little later, some of us were let in for some limited flights, but that's sparked briefly some scenes of chaos as some of the protesters wanted to stop the police who had been brought in to open the doors from doing so. I'm now in and have told I'm boarding a plane, which is several hours late. And it's quite clear from various announcements that several flights are boarding, but there's no up-to-date information on any of the screens. From the Kenyan government's point of view, they're mindful of the fact that Nairobi has traditionally been the major hub and therefore quite lucrative in East Africa. They're looking at other countries elsewhere, Ethiopia with Addis Ababa becoming a big hub. And actually, not too far from here in Rwanda, the government there are building a very big airport with the strategy of trying to steal a lot of that hub traffic.
As Stuart McLean said there, the situation was unclear for plenty of other passengers too.
There's a strike, of course, we understand that. The failure has been the communication from the airlines, from the airport. It has really, really been bad communication. There have been people here since 5 a.m. and just didn't know anything.
Today I will go back to China. This is the first time I find that so many people are crowded here, and I'm afraid that my flight will be delayed. I don't know what's the reason for that.
Well, for more on the chaos, I guess, that was ensuing there at Jomo Kenyatta, we spoke to Alan Kilavuka. He's the chief executive of the country's national airline, Kenya Airways, whose HQ is the airport.
We have major disruptions as a result of the industrial action that was taken by the Kenya Aviation Workers Union. We were supposed to have 21 departures this morning, and we've only had 7 of them so far.
And presumably that could have a massive financial impact on you guys.
Absolutely. And more importantly, a lot of inconveniencing to our customers.
The row itself, do you at Kenya Airways have a view on it?
Not at the moment. All we are asked for is for engagement, which we are currently engaging with the Ministry and with the Airports Authority.
Do you understand the concerns of the main union?
The striking employees of Kenya Airports Authority claim that their jobs could be at risk. They're also requesting to have full visibility of the concessioning arrangement between the concessionaire and the grantor, which is Kenya Airports Authority. So that is their concern.
Do you think people should be concerned about jobs? You know the aviation sector well.
Well, I think at the moment what they Kenya Airports Authority have done is to set up engagements with the various stakeholders, like ourselves, because we're the biggest operator here, and even the Kenya Aviation Workers Union. So the important thing is to have the engagement so that there's clarity with regard to what the impact of the concessioning would be to the various parties.
Do you accept the kind of central premise as well that there needs to be, we were hearing this yesterday on the programme, that there needs to be work at the airport, that the airport needs modernising?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about that. There is a lot of need for modernization of the airport and expansion, and that's not in doubt whatsoever.
And in terms of the disruption now, what's your sense? Could this be days that you could be impacted for, do you think?
I don't know. I know that the Airports Authority are currently arranging to have talks with the union, and I know the government is involved as well. So we hope that it will come to a quick conclusion because it is quite disruptive.
And also to the reputation of Kenya, as you say, as a business hub, a transitioning hub for the whole of the region.
Yes, indeed, yes. But we hope it will come to a conclusion fairly quickly, hopefully by tomorrow if these talks continue.
Alan Kilavuka, the boss of Kenya Airways there. Jewel Karungi, still with us, our correspondent at Jomo Kenyatta Airport. So those talks that Alan Kilavuka was talking about, Jewel, where did they get to? Because I know you've been speaking to the union, amongst others.
Yes, we did get information, Will, that the officials were meeting government representatives to try and see if they are able to get a solution, really, to ending this stalemate. Earlier, I spoke to the national treasurer of the Kenya Airport Workers Union, and he was talking about how concerned they are about the plight of passengers who are stranded here, but at the same time, how committed they are to ensure that this doesn't come through. And this is what he had to say.
This strike has been postponed 3 times to give dialogue a chance, but the government is playing tricks with the workers. They are in a meeting in town to try and resolve this issue of this quagmire, which has paralyzed operation at JKIA. Without dropping the issue of Adani, we are not taking anything less. That is our biggest concern.
The views of the Kenya Aviation Workers Union there, Jewel. What about the government? What have they had to say about what happens next?
Well, the government has said that they have not yet finalized this deal, that they are still in talks with Adani Group in order to pursue a public-private partnership that would see the Adani Group inject some $2 billion into the upgrade of Nairobi's main airport. They say that the airport is already operating beyond capacity. The president was on record last month saying that the airport was currently handling about 7.5 million passengers and the capacity is already very stretched. So he says that this much-needed private investment would help the airport upgrade and be able to handle more volumes even as it becomes East Africa's main transit hub, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And B, in that competition, as Stuart McLean, the Africa business, the Africa Bureau editor for the BBC, was talking about in that kind of competition across the region. Jewel, thanks so much for your time there. That's Jewel Karungi there, our correspondent in Kenya, speaking to us live from outside Jomo Kenyatta International Airport.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the global investigations podcast from the BBC.
You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Still to come on the programme, what makes a good coffee shop? Less confusing choice and better chairs, apparently. We'll hear why the new boss of Starbucks is betting on getting us comfy as he seeks to try and turn the company's future around. That'll come up a little bit later on in the programme. First of all, you might have heard it in the news headlines. Big news from the United States, and not just for the US, but potentially for all of the rest of us, hoping that our key borrowing rates, our interest rates, might fall in the back half of this year. Russ Mould, Investment Director at the UK investment platform AJ Bell, is with us as always on a Wednesday. Russ, great to have you on the programme as always. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, good. This was interesting data, wasn't it? Because the number came in showing that US inflation finally starting to fall, and fall quite significantly.
Certainly a cooling in the rate of growth, absolutely, for the fifth consecutive month, down to 2.5%. Now, the core inflation number, which excludes important things to you and I, like energy and fuel and food and drink, that was actually unchanged at 3.2%. Which is why financial markets have had a little bit of a wobble today, wondering whether that gives the Federal Reserve enough room for manoeuvre to cut interest rates next week on the 18th of September. But the fact that the headline number is at 2.5, its preferred inflation measure of the personal consumption index is also at 2.5, well, that's 3 full percentage points where the current interest rate is. So in real terms, that's a fat interest rate, and that probably does give the Fed room to cut if it wants to.
Yeah, an important point that Russ always makes when we say falling. Prices still confusingly rising, but just not as quickly as they were. Digging through the data, Russ, as you say, those sort of more volatile bits, for example, what stood out to you as perhaps areas that might still be cause for concern for Jerome Powell, the head of the US Central Bank?
Energy is probably one of the things that's going the right way right now, particularly with oil being weak. But if you look at the Atlanta Fed sticky inflation index, it's still things like season tickets, insurance, healthcare, things that don't change every single month. They are proving resilient. And because wage growth is relatively okay, consumers are still spending, it's services prices that are going up, not the prices of manufactured goods. And again, that's possibly a little bit harder to stamp out of the system.
We'll come to energy in just a moment as well. But before we do, always worth making this linkage as to why, how significant what the United States chooses to do with its borrowing rates, why that matters to, I guess, the rest of us listening in other parts of the world.
Yeah, America is the world's biggest economy. It's home to its reserve currency, the dollar, the world's biggest stock market, the world's biggest bond market. So generally where America goes, the world tends to follow. I guess what's interesting this time is that you've actually had Europe and the UK move before the Federal Reserve. But if the Federal Reserve is moving to stimulate its economy, then that would generally be seen as a good thing, providing, I guess, that it's not cutting interest rates in a panic because it's overdone it and the economy is already massively slowing down, which is something that financial markets have started to worry about, actually something that we saw in both 2000 and 2007. So markets like to see rate cuts, but for the right reason, slower inflation, not, quote, for the wrong reason, a big economic slowdown or a financial crisis.
Right, and you sense that there are those jitters on the latter, that they might have gone left this too late.
I mean, that's a fear. I mean, you have seen unemployment creep up by nearly a full percentage point. Job vacancies have come down. And some of the other indicators like manufacturing and purchasing managers' indices haven't been particularly strong. So there are concerns. And talking to some hedge funds last week, there was a bit of a smell of panic out there last Friday ahead of the American jobs number, and that if it was seen to be particularly weak, there was even discussions the Federal Reserve may respond with a 0.75 percentage point cut at next Thursday's meeting. The current consensus is a 0.25 point with around a third chance of a 0.5 point cut. And if you look in the past history, bigger than 0.25 point cuts from the Fed have generally come at times of economic or financial market difficulty. So again, not necessarily something that you actually want to see.
Yeah, more from Russ a little bit later on in the programme. We mentioned energy and energy prices moving around. I wonder whether last night's presidential debate, the first in the United States of this particular run in to November's election, may have an impact on that too, because the debate proved pretty spiky at times, personal, perhaps not as much on our subject matter, the economy, that you might have expected for an election which we sense is going to be dominated by people's perceptions of said economy's performance. But there was talk of energy. Here's the Democratic Party candidate Kamala Harris on the shale gas industry.
In particular, let's talk about fracking because we're here in Pennsylvania. I made that very clear in 2020. I will not ban fracking. I have not banned fracking as Vice President of the United States. And in fact, I was the tie-breaking vote on the Inflation Reduction Act, which opened new leases for fracking. My position is that we have got to invest in diverse sources of energy so we reduce our reliance on foreign oil.
Claire Fisler is with us, climate and energy reporter with Politico, joining us from Washington, D.C. Claire, thanks so much for being with us on World Business Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Music to the ears last night, I guess, for the shale gas industry.
Yeah. You know, this has become a really controversial topic, and it's come up because Vice President Harris, during her first presidential campaign, said she would ban fracking, and now she's saying she won't. Now, she does say that her values haven't changed here. But it's important to note that despite this focus on the flip-flopping, you know, the United States is producing more oil and natural gas today than ever before, far more than any other country. And today, oil and gas accounts for 3/4 of our U.S. energy consumption.
The flip-flopping was because that's precisely what former President Trump accused her of, right, in the debate, and that's what she was responding to there. The other element of it that's important is, as she talked about, where they were debating in the state of Pennsylvania. That's going to be a key state in the election, and is also a place where a lot of this activity is happening.
That's correct. I was actually just on the ground last week reporting from some of the counties that have the most fracking. And as you pointed out, Pennsylvania is a huge state for this energy source, second only to Texas. But the people on the ground I spoke with, they've been dealing with fracking for almost 20 years in those communities. And it's a point of concern for pollution, air pollution, water pollution. And what I heard from on the ground is that people want to turn the page on this, and folks on the ground would like to see more clean energy. Unfortunately, Pennsylvania is not serving that up to those constituents. They have only 4% renewable energy in the state, which is far lower than all the other battleground states that are important this election.
Right. So your sense on the ground, Claire, was that if people had an option, maybe they would pick a different option, but that they don't really, that these are the jobs that they've got in some of those communities.
Right. So this is the concerns. There are concerns about the economy, about inflation, and those are real concerns. Natural gas industry has produced a lot of jobs for that region. And so I think people are conflicted. Of course, they enjoy the jobs that it's brought to their community, but they are fed up, they told me, with this source of energy that is not as clean as it could be.
Such an interesting point that you raise about the kind of volumes of, I guess, for a catch-all term, fossil fuel energy the United States is producing at the moment. Do you sense that in the run-up to this election, that argument, I suppose, that element of the kind of environmental argument, again, for another catch-all, is not quite as powerful as perhaps it has been in other bits of the electoral cycle, that perhaps people aren't quite as focused on it as much? I mean, it's quite telling, isn't it, that both sides, Republicans and Democrats, seem to be agreeing now, for example, on shale gas?
Right. So the topic of climate change and clean energy really has not been on the forefront of this election. And I think a lot of environmental groups are disappointed by that. That said, the Biden-Harris administration has passed the largest climate laws in U.S. history. And so comes to shove, you know, Vice President Harris can always lean on that. And she said that she would expand on those laws and build on them. But it is a tightrope walk that she is walking as the leading candidate for the Democratic Party, both trying to cater to groups that that like to see job creation from natural gas, but also those who would like to see a new type of energy taking root in America at a large scale.
And just because you mentioned, Claire, that you've been out and about on the road in some of these communities recently, do you sense that people are feeling that in their communities? You know, we've talked loads on the program over the past few years about, well, first of all, the infrastructure bill of the early years of the Biden administration that had some of that in it, right? It was trying to get people out of cars and things like that and sort of other projects around that. And then obviously the Inflation Reduction Act itself that was a more targeted move towards greener energy. Have people seen the benefit from those jobs or planned jobs, planned investment yet? Or is that part of the problem here?
My reporting in the South of the United States has shown tremendous support from the communities, because some of the manufacturing communities from, you know, new solar panel plants have been opening up in the South, EV battery manufacturing plants, and folks in there are very, very supportive. But specific to Pennsylvania, which again is one of the most key states in this election, people are fed up that those benefits from those climate laws have not really reached that state. And so that's going to be an important thing to watch, because while climate change is not at the forefront yet, this is going to be such a close race that just a few thousand votes could be very decisive. And if those voters are concerned about climate, you know, this could really be an important issue.
Really interesting. Thanks so much for breaking down all your reporting for us, Claire. Claire Fissler there, a climate change reporter, climate and energy reporter, sorry, with Politico, joining us from Washington, D.C. Russ Mould still with us from the UK investment firm AJ Bell. Russ, just take us to the oil price, because you mentioned it there, and it's been slipping around a little, hasn't it?
Yeah, using the European benchmark of Brent crude oil, it's actually gone below $70 a barrel for the first time since 2021. And in some ways, this might be helpful for Vice President Harris, because inflation has been a stick with which the Republicans have been beating the Biden administration, and energy prices going up has been a big part of that. So lower energy prices will help, and that may also be part of Vice President Harris's thinking. If you're looking at why oil is weak, fears of an economic slowdown or a recession in the USA and the West, topping off a slowdown in China. Vice President Harris possibly opening the taps on shale, where oil production's nearly doubled and gas production's more than doubled in the US. And also OPEC, at some stage, will be increasing its production again, even if it's postponed that by a couple of months.
And a story we should probably always keep dropping in on is GameStop. That people will know it from being a meme share, you know, one of these Reddit
internet
ones
play
that goes
thing, I think, is the best
up and down a bit.
It
actually had some actual financial numbers out today, and surprise, surprise, they weren't very good.
No, the shares are down by a sixth on the New York Stock Exchange. Sales were down in all three of its revenue streams, hardware, software, collectibles. It just about scraped a profit, but is still struggling to make itself really relevant as a business in a world where video games are now being streamed rather than bought through in physical format from brick and mortar shops. And although the company's got around $4 billion worth of cash on its balance sheet, it is filing to sell more shares to raise another $500 million. Quite what it's going to do with that is open to question.
Get your information from everywhere, not just Reddit message boards, is probably a bit of advice to get from there, isn't it, as well? Russ, stay with us, because I want to get your thoughts on this item as well, because we need to head off to the coffee shop. Depending on where you are in the world, may be a little late for coffee or the perfect time, but what makes a good one? It's been a question that the new boss of Starbucks has been asking in his early days in the job, and he thinks he's got a bit of an answer. This is Brian Nickel, who's moved there from Chipotle, one of America's other big food chains, the kind of taco and burrito chain. He reckons comfy chairs are part of the answer. So what does make a good coffee house, and what makes us want to go in? Roland Horn is joining us now. He's the founder of Watch House Coffee Shop, a chain here in the UK, joins us from London. Roland, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Pleasure.
What makes a good coffee shop, then?
I think it depends on the value base of the business themselves. So for us, it's about human connection. And I note that Brian Nichol made notice of wanting to try and reconnect with Starbucks as cultural, so-called third way, connecting, you know, post office, post home into that third place where people can relax and have connection. I think it's true to say that they've moved past that in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, challenger brands such as Watch House and others within our space are obviously hitting that that traditional Starbucks ground.
Yeah, because you've got a good experience right across the industry working for kind of bigger chains and now in the more independent sector. Is it fair to say that Starbucks perhaps opened that door, though, for what's come since, that they were kind of the first, that they were the innovation to say, you know what, coffee is a thing that you do go and sit and spend time with in a space rather than just buy and jump in the car and carry on commuting or jump on the train or whatever?
I could bore you academically on the answer to that question, but in the interest of time, I would say no. They're an absolute pioneer, an absolute pioneer in our industry. They have opened many, many doors for many, you know, operators such as ourselves and others within the sort of quick service restaurant and grab and go areas. I think fundamentally, this is about an evolution of a business. In some ways, holding on to the former, the founder and the former CEO, Howard Schultz, seeking to try and, I guess, be. You know, my mantra now is maybe what his was 30 years ago, and that, you know, we want to come in and really have that human connection. And I think that's there's a sort of misalignment there between maybe founder's cultural values of what he wants Starbucks to be versus maybe what it is, which is more that grab and go convenience offering, which I think they're excellent at doing.
Russ Mulwood, the reason that he's having to lay all this out in a letter to staff and investors today is that Starbucks' performance, stock market-wise, has been pretty poor in the last few years.
Yeah, it's been disastrous. And intriguingly, since Brian Nichol took over, the shares are actually up by a fifth. So his record at his previous employer, Chipotle, has clearly made a tremendous impression with shareholders. And they are looking forward to exciting things going forwards.
How difficult, Roland, as a kind of leader, is it to write something that's gone off the rails, but to get back to... certainly from what Brian Nichol thinks that they're good at, as you were saying in your kind of first answer. How hard is that to sort of, when you know something's going wrong, to go, right, okay, hang on, we need to strip all this back again?
I think being the sort of visionary founder of a business versus a parachuted in CEO, it makes it very different and very much harder or much easier. And I'd say that with the former, you know, Howard Schultz has been in three times, parachuted back in as CEO after retiring three times, of course, once famously to try and consider running for the US presidential election, I believe in 2008. I think him coming back in because of the founder and the sort of this get up and go starter of the business, I think it makes it much easier to sort of culturally move that vessel back on course. But of course, you know, this is 38,000 cafes across the globe, of course, half of which is in the US, half is internationally, very dominated towards China. So it's a huge, huge job. I think he has to talk about cultural development within his business. Of course he does, but I do think they should lean into what Starbucks is now, which is a best-in-class grab-and-go chain coffee operator across the world and what they do.
And jokes apart, how important are comfy chairs? Are they important in your shops?
They're hugely important and undervalued, but I would say so is the air conditioning, the music, the culture, the smile, everything that comes with being in these places. And that's what Watch House is looking to try and do.
So what you're selling, an experience as much as a cup of whatever anybody's drinking?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and how hard is it to keep your eye on that when, you know, price and energy and all that kind of all those other things are going on around the business?
Well, I think in our business, the big levers that really move the dial are the ones in which it's, you know, more to do with employment costs, business rates, yeah. And that could, those overheads. I think the sort of macro commodity pricing happening in principally Brazil and Vietnam is relatively irrelevant.
But keeping your eyes on the ambience all the time. Roland, great to get your insight. Thanks so much. That's Roland Horn of the Watch House coffee shop chain. Big thanks too to Russ Mulwood, Investment Director at the UK Investors, AJ Bell, and of course for all of you for listening to World Business Report.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.